blaze of...
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
On News Talk.
Fire by his granddaughter, Lynn Rose Clark. As well as a folk hero, Hilliard was one of Ireland's first Olympians and a complicated figure, to say the least. And to tell us more about Bob Hilliard, Cameron Hill from Off the Ball. Cameron, good morning.
Good morning, Pat. How are you?
I'm very well. Where was he from?
New Street, Killarney, in County Kerry. So he was born on the 7th of April, 1904, to Robert Martin Hilliard, also Robert Martin, who ran a footwear factory with his brother, John. Now, it seems as though Robert Martin Sr. really wanted to give the younger Robert as many opportunities as possible, the opportunities he didn't get, and made a great deal of sacrifices to give him the proper education. So young Robert is sent to Middleton College in 1915. He leaves after one term and then moves to Cork Grammar School, then goes to the Mountjoy School in Dublin for 1 year, really cracks the books, and manages to gain a Reed Sizership to Trinity College.
What does that mean?
So it was granted to students of limited means, receiving free evening meals in exchange for the performance of certain duties. You tend to really only find it at Trinity and the University of Cambridge. The award still exists today in some form, known as the Reed Entrance Exhibition. It is open only to students of limited means who are natives of County Kerry.
Now, Trinity was important because he learned to do a couple of things.
Two really important activities: debating. So he was a frequent speaker at these debates at the Historical Society in Trinity, which really informs his politics, which I'll leave a pin in and come back to because it is important later in the story. Boxing caught his attention in 1922. So he won the Trinity Boxing Club's novices competition in the bantamweight division. Years of playing rugby in Cork Grammar School and other places had steeled him for combat sport, gave him a love of physicality and endurance.
Clark, he would have been small enough now if he was a bantamweight fighter. He would have been a small man.
Yeah, a little scrapper, you might say.
Yeah.
And as Clark notes, boxing really appeals to his urge to live on the edge, which we will see more of later in his story. But he spent most of his time in the boxing gym, managed to sign up for the Trinity Hurling Club, which again, key identifier of his Republican leanings at this time. And the fact that he couldn't go down to Kerry during this period, so this is around 1922-23, during the Irish Civil War, cut off the rail network between Dublin and Kerry. So he was stuck up in Dublin and he only had really boxing to do, yeah. Boxing and debating. So it meant he could really hone his craft.
Now, the Olympics were beckoning in 1924 in Paris.
Yes, and it was to be the first Olympics that Ireland would fully take part in. So you remember from last week, there was an Irish team sent to 1906, yeah. But this was the first team of the Irish Free State in Paris, 1924, and Hilliard wanted to make the boxing team. So the IABA championships were down for June of that year at Portobello Barracks and served effectively as trials for the Olympic team. He was up against his chief rival, Daniel Flaherty, for the bantamweight place. A member of the Volunteers fought him on June 6th, and he won that match. It was a particularly prolific period for Hilliard. In a very short space of time, so in 10 days, he fought 8 times, won 6, picked up two titles, and gained a place on the Olympic team. It ended up making him rather shattered by the end of that period, but he would then lose to Flaherty later that month at a charity event. So it probably did catch up with him eventually.
Now, you mentioned his biographer, his granddaughter, Lynn Rose Clark, and you've been talking to her.
Yes, and she was explaining how her grandfather's growing interest in boxing at that time coincided nicely with the Irish public seeing this sport as a great unifier in the early days of independence.
His rise as a boxer was meteoric, and I think he did enjoy that. He was very, very competitive, and he was an entertainer. He was a performer. And so he's a popular figure in the ring, which, you know, of course, he just loved. He had a tremendous sense of humour. And he would take this smiling, jokey, charismatic air into the boxing ring. So there's one match which is described in the book where it says that, you know, he and his opponent were the stars of the show. And I can sort of well believe it from the newspaper reports. The newspaper articles are very interesting, and the press was absolutely glued to this huge upsurge of interest in boxing in Ireland that happened after 1922. It's very much part of establishing a new national identity, and they were determined that there's going to be this Olympic team that would be cross-sectarian, that would be cross-border, that would be very, very inclusive, and that would also be a marker of Irish excellence.
Now, he did go to the Olympics. How did he do?
Well, Not very well. So just an overview of Ireland's Olympics. First Olympics, 44 nations competing in Paris that year. The biggest Olympics so far. John O'Grady was the flag bearer, a weight thrower who stood at 6'4" and over 18 stone with a 54-inch chest, nicknamed the baby. America's Johnny Weissmuller, who later played Tarzan, and you'll remember was a friend of Mysterious Montague when we did that episode. He won 4 medals in swimming. Ireland's first ever international football match took place there when they played Bulgaria and won 1-0 before losing to the Netherlands in the quarterfinals. And things like the Olympic Village and the release of doves at the opening ceremony, that was the first time they had appeared in an Olympics. The Irish boxing team fairly swiftly wiped out. All pretty close, maybe contentious decisions. So Morris Doyle was the featherweight. He was beaten by 16-year-old American Jacob Finkelstein, known as Jackie Fields, who won the gold. He's still the youngest ever boxing gold medalist at an Olympics. John Pa Kelleher was lightweight. He lost to Ben Rothwell of the US. Willie Boy Murphy fared better. He received a bye into the round of 32, beat Eugenius Novak of Poland in the last 16, lost to Canadian Leslie Black in what the Irish Independent described as an outrageous decision. Paddy Dwyer came closest to a medal. He beat Britain's James Basham in the round of 32, reached the bronze final where he lost to Canada's Douglas Lewis.
And Hilliard?
He lost in the last 16 to Argentina's Benito Pertuzzo.
Now, after his Olympic adventures, he meets a woman.
It's around this time, actually, when he's starting to make a play for the Olympic team that he meets a woman named Rosemary Robbins, a somewhat shy and rather religious young woman, according to Clark's book, at a dinner party in Merrion Square. So after the Olympics ends, Hilliard gets on a train from Gare du Nord at the crack of dawn, and by dusk that same day, he reaches Rosemary's house in Gomshall in Surrey and camps in a tent outside. His aunt sees this strange individual camping outside their house and invites him in, and that's where the love really kindles. Drops out of his degree, much to the disappointment of his father, starts visiting Rosemary every weekend. Rosemary then becomes pregnant, which was apparently very distressing for both of them, and he married her in something of a shotgun wedding. And Hilliard had originally been working as a copywriter before moving to journalism, neither of which paid very well. They were suffering from serious financial problems when he resolved to become a Church of Ireland minister after a meeting with the leader of the Oxford Group, which was a sect of Anglicanism with a focus on personal spirituality and a rejection of fear and selfishness. So he goes back to Trinity, gets his BA in Divinity, and does a bit of boxing on the side as well.
Now, he goes to Derriahy, just outside Belfast. So he's still, it's not a well-paid job. He's still struggling.
Yeah, it's one of the poorer Protestant parishes in Northern Ireland, and the financial struggles continue, which is such a shame, because Clark, in the book and when she was speaking to me, said that he was a very lively and entertaining preacher and minister, and he then gets a full-time post at St. Anne's Cathedral in Belfast. But in 1934, when he's really deep in debt, he's refused a loan from the cathedral's dean, and that marks a change. It is a life-changing moment.
Now, we mentioned that he was anti-treaty, and, you know, why does he end up in a Christy Moore song?
So during the Irish Civil War, he was anti-treaty, as you say. He took part in Fianna Fáil debates throughout his college career and up until this point. But then he witnesses something really interesting. The outdoor relief strikes of 1932 in Belfast, where members of the working class from across the sectarian divide united together to march for welfare reforms and a fair living wage. And he's pretty taken aback by this. It marks a real shift in his politics towards the left. And in 1935, he moves to London, leaving Rosemary and their children behind, and becomes an active member of the Communist Party. When civil war breaks out in Spain in July of the following year, 1936, I should say, in December, he heads off to fight with the international brigades, which are forming to fight the fascist-backed Francoist forces. And he sends a very interesting postcard to Rosemary at this time. Very poignant. "I still hate fighting," which, as a boxer, I'm a little bit reluctant to believe. "But this time, it's got to be done. Unless we end fascism in Spain and in the world, it will be war and hell for our kids." So there was a real philanthropic giving man here. He was very fond of his children and wanted a better future for them, and that's what prompted him to go over to Spain and fight.
What happened to him?
part of the British Battalion in the 5th International Brigade, as Christy Moore sings in the song, formed at Madrigueras in Albacete. So on the 14th of February 1937, the British Battalion members were rallying to keep Franco's forces from cutting off the road between Madrid and Valencia at Jarama. Hilliard, who was only one of 125, I should say, riflemen to survive the first day of fighting, is shot in the neck. Now, we don't know precisely when or how that happened. He's brought to a hospital in Castellón, and Robert Hilliard dies on the 22nd of February, age just 32.
So he is remembered in song at any rate, and now you've given us the background to his Olympic story as well. Lynn, his granddaughter, is going to be speaking, I believe.
Yes, on the 14th, in 14 Henrietta Street, as part of the Dublin Festival of History on September 29th, should be over. That book, Swift Blaze of Fire, definitely recommend anyone picking it up. It's available in Easons, Dubray Books, Hodges Figgis, Books Upstairs, and direct from lilliputpress.ie. But it's a great exploration of her relationship with her grandfather and the legacy of someone whose most famous moment comes at what was a really traumatic moment for their family, because he ups and leaves them to sort of fend off the creditors and fight their debts themselves. So that complication is a very interesting thread throughout that book.
Cameron Hill from Off the Ball.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.